Welcome to episode one of the N3SP podcast, a production of the National Security Strategic Studies Partnership, or N3SP. Our guest today is Madison Walker. She is a Space Policy Research Fellow at the Institute for Future Conflict, teaches in the Department of Political Science, and is the Deputy Director of the Eisenhower Center for Space and Defense Studies, all of which are at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Madison earned her law degree at the University of Mississippi, which has an area of concentration in air and space law. After working in the private sector, she accepted a fellowship from the Institute for Future Conflict and is about to wrap up her first year at the Academy. As a disclaimer, let me begin by saying that the opinions and ideas expressed on this podcast do not necessarily represent the official positions of any government, academic, or commercial entities mentioned herein. Madison will be presenting her research under the title, Not With a Bang, But a Blinding, about how we might lose access to space from non-kinetic attacks. Now, I hope I've given an adequate lead-in to prompt listeners' interest for this fascinating and relevant topic, so I'll hand it over to Madison.
Yes, absolutely, Darren. And I am so honored to be the inaugural participant for the N3SP podcast and to share my research with everybody and you lovely folks.
Well, thank you. And again, Madison was part of an Eisenhower Center impromptu meeting we had where we discussed coming up with a podcast idea. So credit is given where credit is due in helping to come up with this idea in the first place. So first of all, for the folks that are interested in this topic but may not be subject matter experts, can you describe what you mean by saying a non-kinetic attack in space and how that ties into your analogy here of not a bang, but a blinding?
Yes, absolutely. So the majority of satellites, if not all of them, have to have access to the electromagnetic spectrum in order to work. So frequency waves that they use to communicate to gain uplink and downlink data to either control the system or to actually beam down the data that the satellite is collecting, they have to use this spectrum. And internationally, the International Telecommunications Union is in charge of allocating those spectrum frequencies, delineating accidental harmful interferences. And then here in the United States, we have the Federal Communications Commission, which is in charge of interfacing for commercial aspects between the commercial aspects and the ITU and allocating the domestic frequency bands. And then the NTIA is the government's intermediary for government satellites and usage of that. So spectrum is very important to how we actually are able to use our satellites. Without spectrum access, we completely lose the ability to really use our space assets how they are supposed to be used. So a non-kinetic attack is jamming or blinding or spoofing, basically interfering in a way that cuts off the satellite from its ability to either be controlled from the ground, so the uplink, or provide the data that that satellite is purposed with tasking and gathering, so the downlink. So that would be an intentional or very reckless interference with the satellite's ability to access that spectrum.
And that's what you'd say, it's an attack against the space segment, right? So this is directed against a satellite that's in orbit, whether a low orbit or as far out as a geosynchronous orbit, right? It's not talking about going against anything that's on the ground, correct?
Absolutely. Well, and so more broadly and generally, I was talking about both the uplink and the downlink. So the uplink is targeting the space segment itself. The downlink is targeting the ability for that satellite to provide data to the ground. Now, both would be an interference, but there is different levels of responsibility of interference. When you're attacking the uplink and the satellite's ability to maneuver itself, the satellite's ability to really provide safety measures, traffic measures, that is going to be a far more irresponsible way of jamming, spoofing, blinding a satellite than just attacking the downlink data that it's providing to various stakeholders. The downlink still is a problem because you are preventing data that should be reaching the ground from reaching the ground, but it's not as dangerous or irresponsible as attacking the uplink or the space segment itself.
Or on the high end of actually irresponsible activity, I guess we'd call that the kinetic attack, which would be physically connecting with and destroying a satellite in orbit. Examples being, you know, more famously, the 2007 Chinese attack on their own test against their own weather satellite, which created several tens of thousands of pieces of debris, if I can recall correctly.
Yes, absolutely. And kinetic attacks definitely are taking up a lot of the conversation, and for good reason, because of the debris that's created and the almost catastrophic consequences that it could have, either creating a Kessler syndrome or really just creating certain orbits that are not useful anymore because of the amount of debris circulating around in them. So kinetic attacks take up a lot of the conversation, which is important because they do have a lot of catastrophic effects. However, because kinetic attacks are taking up so much of the conversation, we're not really looking at non-kinetic attacks, and it's almost seen as something that doesn't even matter or that doesn't have a consequence, which is not true, especially when you're talking about the reckless jamming, even of the downlink, reckless downlink jamming of satellites being able to provide GPS data or other things of that nature. For example, FalconSat 8 has been experiencing our satellite here run by the cadets at the Academy has been experiencing GPS errors over the Crimean Peninsula. Now, FalconSat 8 is probably not being targeted directly by targeted GPS jamming. It's more of a wide GPS jamming that is happening. And that can affect FalconSat 8's telemetry, but also civilian services, emergency services that are using GPS data in order to locate and find people in trouble in that time of crisis of war. So you have a distinction issue when you are just doing this wide targeting, and you're having a issue that can really affect a third and second order of safety.
So this is something that, although we're dealing with modern late 20th, 21st century technology, really does, as you referenced there, come up against traditional concept of international law, like distinction, right?
Absolutely. And the Outer Space Treaty very explicitly says that any basically law that is not more specific, laid out here in the Outer Space Treaty, any other international law is transposed to space. And that includes the law of armed conflict. And thus we need to be aware and we need to try to minimize the effects that war has on civilian lives and civilian infrastructure. And that includes things that space provides that becomes part of our daily lives, GPS, PNT, atomic clock provisions, right? Communications. These are all things that have become largely space-based and that civilians rely upon. And by just broadly interfering with spectrum of that kind, you cut civilians off from necessary parts of their daily lives.
And civilians who might be in the combat area would be affected by that and lose, as you said, maybe even essential emergency services. But because of the global footprint of a satellite, depending on where it actually is in orbit, that could go beyond the actual zone of conflict, couldn't it?
Absolutely. LEO orbits, I believe it is about every 90 minutes, it tracks around the globe, depending on how high it is. And the errors that it's experiencing from jamming could cause systems to fail further. It could cause more errors in their sensors and down the line. That is also something FalconSat 8 has been experiencing. It takes a while for the satellite to kind of reset itself after experiencing such interference. And spectrum is more regionally located, but can also have global implications. So that is definitely something that doesn't just stop at borders when you're doing that. It can have more down the line effects.
So the chance of conflict spreading as a result of an attempt of one country to use its space assets, counter space assets, shall we say, against another country could start to bring in other originally non-combatant countries. So that may be a good point to transition to your concept here of escalation ladders. How do you see the concept of escalation applying here, and what might we do confronted with this sort of situation? Speaking mostly from the U.S. perspective, but if there's an international component, please feel free to describe that as well.
Absolutely. So I think the first rung would need to be to start calling out non-kinetic attacks for what they are, non-kinetic attacks. Especially when you are showing that it is intentional or reckless to the point of being grossly negligent in an interference of a wide variety of users, then that needs to be condemned publicly on the international stage, not just by the U.S., but by all affected countries, anybody who has an interest in this. It needs to be called out, because one of the reasons that this is so widely used at the moment is because there really isn't a lot of international backlash when you're using spectrum interference as a way to cut off people from their space assets. And so more international condemnation and backlash needs to be applied when using this specific tactic.
So why do you think there isn't more outcry for this, given the fact that this could cause a regional war to start to spill into neighboring countries? Or if you're talking about a service that relies on a low Earth orbiting system, it could easily be spread around the world in that 90-minute orbit. Why isn't there more outcry? Why don't people get together on this type of non-kinetic interference?
I think it's a couple things. I think first, and kind of what we discussed earlier, is that kinetic attacks are taking up so much of the conversation because they are devastating if they were to become common practice. So people are really trying to start there and work backwards. I think the second thing is it's hard to prove. Spectrum is a very tight resource, and thus harmful interference that is unintentional does happen, and that does require mediation at the ITU and people and countries coming together to try to deconflict spectrum as best as possible. But interference is still going to happen, and there is an allowable amount of interference. So it's proving that it's intentional and or reckless. However, in certain circumstances, it's hard not to say that it would be intentional and or a broad jamming to the extent. So it does have a higher bar for proving the intentionality aspect. And then third, I'd also say the overclassification or even the taboo of talking about issues in space. The U.S., very much so, if you want to talk about space almost in any aspect with a U.S. government official, you need some sort of classification. And we have things from the 60s that are still classified, right? Technology in that aspect. So we're very protective over our space technology, mostly for good reason, but there is an overclassification issue. We don't want to talk about anything that's going on in space for fear of being, of showing our cards or showing our hands in that certain arena.
Well, in fairness, I know you've had a little bit of time with the private sector as well. The private sector seems to have a strong impulse to not want to discuss in too great a detail what their systems are doing, at least in terms of their up and down time, because that affects their bottom line and reliability with regard to customers, doesn't it? So isn't there just a general reluctance to share too much information or share any more information than absolutely necessary that maybe holds people back here?
You are definitely correct on that. Commercial companies don't want to state problems they're experiencing or anything like that because of the very slim margins on these space activities and how fragile it can be to run a space company. Space is still very expensive. It's gone down a lot, but the margins are still not the greatest. And so if customers really start to perceive that this is not a reliable product, that this can be messed with very easily, that's not going to be great for the company. The company does not want to be marketing that they are experiencing a whole host of problems as well. And that is also something we need to address with resiliency and kind of how the Space Force in particular is going to go about trying to protect these assets and protect their ability to continue to stay online and stay on service. But it's true. It's a whole space-wide problem of not wanting to show any weakness because of the thin margins that we're operating on.
Okay, so if I could summarize what you've described for this first rung in the ladder of trying to control escalation, it's the idea of trying to call out this type of interference, again, non-kinetic, as it's happening. And there are a variety of reasons why that's not maybe being done as aggressively as possible, ranging from, you know, being able to prove, attribute the action to a particular aggressor state, and also, you know, the limitations on sharing information that you're going to say, hey, I'm being jammed, because there may be reasons you don't want to reveal that, either as a government security concern or a commercial interest, as you just outlined. So what would be the second rung on the ladder? If we can't shut this down, as you recommend, by calling it out and handling it through public engagement in international forums or what would you do next?
So as far as ladder of escalation, I kind of have two steps in the ladder. One step that we need to be doing kind of completely is really ramping up our resiliency and being aware and ramping up our technology of how we can reduce jamming, basically making it not worth with when you're pairing it with the public backlash, make it not worth this especially generalized jamming, where targeted jamming would become harder, but so would generalized jamming, as far as building up your resiliency capabilities in that way. And that should be an undercurrent throughout, just trying to really deny them their negative effects. But the next one after that would be targeted downlink jamming that makes it clear that we will respond in kind with jamming, but in a more responsible way. So not targeting the space segment, but targeting downlink jamming of military objectives of the states we believe are responsible for this irresponsible practice. And so we've already called them out, and now we are showing them that the only ones who will feel the pain is them, because they will not be receiving the benefits of their space act, of their space assets. And we will do it in a way that does not put satellites in, do not turn satellites into basically hunks of debris that can't be moved, and do not punish civilian emergency assets, but is targeted jamming of the downlink to show that we can also take away your space assets as well.
And that would be acceptable under existing outer space law?
Yes. So outer space law, it's very generalized. A lot of people kind of conflate this idea of military activity. So military activity is allowed in orbit. It's only celestial bodies that are supposed to be used for exclusively peaceful purposes. Weapons of mass destruction are prohibited from being placed in orbit. Now, what that means can be very, very widely, right? Technically, an ASAT that causes a Kessler syndrome, you could argue, is a weapon of mass destruction. But as far as military activities, and especially jamming the downlink, there is nothing in the Outer Space Treaty or even state practice that would go forth in that, especially because it is in response to intentional or reckless jamming from the aggressor state. So they have already basically violated their obligations under the ITU and the Outer Space Treaty, and thus the return of violating obligations, but in a thus, in return, the obligation disappears, the reciprocal obligation disappears under the ITU to respect your spectrum. And then under the Outer Space Treaty, the other side is engaged in an internationally wrongful act. Two wrongs don't make a right. But when you're talking about proportionality in response to an attack, this is definitely in line with both the LOAC, as well as being a more responsible way of jamming that adheres to all the other LOAC law of armed conflict principles. This idea of response would be in line with international law in my view.
Thank you for clarifying the acronym LOAC,
yes.
Because we tend to use that a lot, but again, that may not be a widely known term, depending on the variety of people we hope are listening to this podcast. The other thing I want to make take time for an explanation is, when we talk about Kessler syndrome, that's derived from the theory by presumably Dr. Kessler, that assumes that at a certain point there will be enough debris in orbit that it will start to collide with each other and generate more debris. So it's kind of a chain reaction tipping point, correct?
Yes, that is the conceptualization.
So hopefully we don't reach that point. That would be an entire discussion to have, an interesting discussion with physicists, and maybe do something on space situational awareness, but we'll hold that off to another day. All right, so we've got calling out interference. We've got the up to the level of a denial of service type of directed jamming in retaliation, proportionate retaliation to an aggressor's non-kinetic acts against space assets. What comes after that? Are we at the top of the ladder?
No, and I do also really want to make clear, it would not, in proportionality speaks, it would actually just be a low level hum or sting, because you're going to identify specific targets that make an impact, but don't cripple their space access, as well as do not target kind of civilian prospects as well, kind of using those emergency services, using the commercial assets. It would be far more of that denial. And it would be a very low hum of just demonstrating capabilities, not continuous, not frequent, just a demonstration of capabilities as far as that goes in the downlink arena. So when you're moving up from that, you turn up the frequency depending on the behavior. And really what I'm talking about here is the idea of broken windows policing has a certain context in the United States, but this idea of trying to hit the lower levels of interference to prevent upwards, to prevent more egregious violations of interference. And really what broken windows policing kind of showed in theory is this idea that disorder leads to fear, which then leads to people acting way out of self-interest, which when we are talking about it in an international and political science context, states reacting out of fear and self-interest can often lead to escalating security dilemmas. And so what we really don't want is this idea as well. So trying to prevent jamming through resiliency, norm creation, and international conversations, but then also we are demonstrating that we have the ability to deny your space assets, but through that more targeted way of feeling. And then as people tend to, depending on the reaction, either increasing the denial of service for the downlinks, and even hitting them in cooperation agreements, going beyond, going to the ITU, really using our partnerships and our space power projection to try to deny them the ability to be a part of the space community, which is still very robust because space is hard and it really relies on having allies and assets in orbit as well.
And I imagine there's a dependence on having customers. So if you can organize the customers to shun bad actors, then maybe you have another lever to exercise some influence.
Absolutely. And we've had good success for kind of something in a similar domain, cyber, of this idea of clean infrastructure and eliminating bad actors from who put malware into the component parts that they're selling, right? And this goes forward to that, because if you are disrespecting other people's spectrum rights under the ITU, the reciprocal process, then you lose your protection as well. So it even is making the case to customers that because of this bad action that people are engaged in, they are losing their protection to provide you a reliable service as well. And really just making the case that that is not something that you want to be spending your money on, because any day it could be turned off or get interfered with because it doesn't have that international protection because of its own bad actions.
And the ITU, if we haven't defined it before, is the International Telecommunications Union, which, like in other forms of law you cited here, actually has a pre-space history, correct? So this is the behaviors that we're trying to encourage in space are similar to those that existing law has tried to shape with regard to, in the ITU's case, radio frequency emissions terrestrially, correct?
Absolutely. The International Telecommunications Union is very old, but it has been very successfully adapted to space. And as far as kind of this idea of coming together and taking a resource in space and doling it out in a way that people, that states have generally been responsive to. And that is because orbits are limited. Space is big, useful space is limited. Orbits and spectrum usage are limited. And in order for anything to work, we have to be able to have, a regime of sharing so we don't lose access to that resource.
Very good. Any other ladder rungs on that escalation ladder, or where is your research taking you from this point?
So I'm continuing to develop the operationalized ability to add more intermediate steps to the ladder as I continue that research, because there are obviously ways to leverage the uniqueness of space and the unique ability of the ITU's power, and also the Articles of the Outer Space Treaty, which in my view have been underutilized to kind of bring people to the table. So I'm definitely researching and trying to articulate more intermediate rungs, but I believe those are kind of the three big points, big shifts in the ladder, if I could say that. Whereas there are definitely smaller steps that will lead up in between those. But it also costs us nothing to call out on the stage, which is why that was the first and initial one.
That makes sense. So, thank you for sharing that insight into certainly an interesting challenge and a provocative concept that, the real effect of a conflict in space may not be the destruction of a satellite, but equally, or maybe I would say equally more dangerous, the sudden loss of those services. In ways that an aggressor might think that it could get away with it. So hopefully the working on an escalatory management framework like you described will prevent that from happening in the first place. So I'm going to close with what I think will be the closing question for each of the podcast guests here in the future and ask you, in the next 5 years, what change or trend in international or domestic politics, economics, law, technology, or even culture will have the greatest impact on national security, in your opinion?
The thing I think is going to have the biggest impact is not directly related to space, but is in a way, is this cultural relationship that we have with privacy, given the new cyber and quite frankly, space capabilities that we have. I believe people have become very nihilistic to what privacy means and what their data should mean to them. And I have many cadets, many young people saying that, well, my data is going to get out there anyway. Why does it matter if it's on, say, TikTok or another app? So this nihilism of, well, nothing's private, so why should I try to keep it private, I think is going to be a huge problem for national security, especially in the U.S. and Europe going forward, because you basically have people's whole lives just reduced down to numbers, and that can be very powerful.
Well, that sounds like an interesting topic to follow up perhaps on a future conversation, but for now, I will close by thanking you very much for, again, having inaugurated the N3SP podcast here, and return you to your day already in progress. But again, thank you very much, and I look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to this first episode of the N3SP podcast. We hope you found it interesting. Future episodes will be forthcoming, presenting the research of other faculty, students, and cadets from universities participating in the partnership. For more information about the N3SP, please go to our website at n3sp.org. Goodbye.